Hi, I'm Alan Saunders, and this week on The Philosopher's Zone, a tribute to a great writer who wasn't quite a philosopher, but whose work undoubtedly had considerable philosophical interest. I'm talking about Claude Lévi-Strauss, who died in October, just a few weeks short of his 101st birthday. He was an anthropologist, and anthropology is, of course, an empirical science, but it's not a million miles from philosophy. How could it be when it looks at what people believe about the world and how they structure their view of it? Lévi-Strauss transformed the subject, and partly because of his own background in philosophy. Instead of analysing different exotic cultures one by one, he sought to identify the formal structures of human thought common to all people in all times and places. He did this first in his book Triste Tropique. You could translate the title as Sad Tropics, but that would do less than justice to its tone of regret and nostalgia. It's an account of his time in the Brazilian Amazon in 1935. To talk about the book and its author, here's Rowan Bastin, Associate Professor of Anthropology at Deakin University.
It describes a philosopher becoming an anthropologist because he feels the limitations of philosophy, and he feels constrained by dealing only with concepts as they're located within the confined spaces of the Western world. He found that the idea of anthropology tremendously liberating, and it was made possible because he and his first wife, who was actually an ethnologist, and so a proper professional anthropologist, participated in the formation of a new university in Sao Paulo in Brazil in the mid-1930s, and he was out there teaching social theory, but he joined his wife on these expeditions, and whilst she doesn't rate more than a single mention in that book, it's something that he seems to have expunged in his personal memoir, I think she was a key influence on him becoming an anthropologist. The book outlines then his trips, his expeditions into the Amazon region, and his encounters with the Native American peoples there. But he's also trying to present the theory of humanity that he wanted to develop, and a theory that had been refined after that time in Brazil when, as a refugee from the Second World War, he lived in New York and came into very close contact with the founding figure of American anthropology, Franz Boas, and he also, in spending time with Boas, he also came to know the members of the structural linguistic school, particularly Roman Jakobson, and that's where he really refined his ideas.
I can't forbear mentioning here, you say he came into contact with Boas, quite literally, because Boas died in his arms, didn't he?
Indeed. Hmm. Indeed. The story is that Boas, who'd spent so much of his, you know, adult professional life developing the concept of culture in sort of radical opposition to the deep-seated racist and eugenics movements in the United States, came to a luncheon where he proudly said that he had a new line of argument. He was by that stage an old man, but he had a heart attack at the luncheon and, yes, died in Lévi-Strauss's arms.
Well, let's look at the fact that he seems to have done very little field research. In the 19th century, there was the Scottish anthropological thinker James Fraser, who died in 1941 and wrote a famous book called The Golden Bough, which was a sort of synoptic account of human religions. But he wrote it without actually travelling very far from his library. Then there was Bronislaw Malinowski, who for two decades of the 20th century was professor of anthropology at the London School of Economics. Now, Malinowski was noted for his fieldwork, for burying himself in an exotic culture, or a culture exotic to him, learning the language and so on. Lévi-Strauss is more like Fraser than Malinowski, isn't he?
Well, he's more like Fraser in the sense that he undertakes the careful and systematic analysis of data that has been collected by others. But unlike Fraser, Levi-Strauss also did his stint of fieldwork. It's something that the British empiricists, very much in the mould of Malinowski, would later come to criticise him for. You know, they treated him as an armchair anthropologist, working through the work of others. But I don't think it's right to think of Levi-Strauss simply as another Fraser. And indeed, I think what he managed to do in his work was to critique the fetishism of fieldwork that had crept into the discipline. You know, the glorious, you've got to get out there with your pith helmet on. And Malinowski was the champion of the deep immersion method. The field trip before Malinowski, to a large extent, took the form of expeditions. So we have, for example, the Torres Strait expedition that was led by Haddon and co, and various other expeditions to various parts of the world. Whereas Malinowski, by dint of historical circumstances, did a prolonged period of fieldwork in Melanesia and produced with that the very, very rich description of the Trobriand Islands. Certainly Levi-Strauss didn't do that, but in a way I think he did something better, which was, well, it's one thing to go out and collect it, but what do we make of it?
Now, one of the things that Levi-Strauss does in Tristes Tropiques is talk about one of his greatest influences, which actually turns out to be the science of geology. Can you tell us about why that mattered to him?
Oh, yes. To me, if you don't understand the importance of geology to Levi-Strauss, you don't understand Levi-Strauss or structuralism. In Tristes Tropiques, he outlines three major influences on his work, and a lot of people find these three influences somewhat odd. The first of them was geology, and geology provided Levi-Strauss from his childhood. He had a childhood fascination with geology, but it provided him with something not dissimilar to what it had provided Charles Darwin, and that was a sense of the longue durée, as the historian Brodel calls it. The idea that in the history of the planet, different moments will come into conjunction and again come into conjunction, and that we get a sense then of the antiquity of the Earth and life on Earth, and realise that it's not all sort of mapped out in a simple progression. And the importance of that is that provided Levi-Strauss with this sense, deep sense of history, but in very much in the longue durée of history, which at the same time enabled him to be critical of the idea that each and every moment is simply a consequence of what immediately preceded it. And so in a sense, it's a deep sense of time, or a sense of deep time, that at the same time makes one critical of one's historical judgments. And this is a very radical position with respect to ideas of history, ideas of human evolution, concepts like social Darwinism, and the notion that certain societies were at different evolutionary stages or civilizational stages than others. And so what we find with Levi-Strauss and the use of geology, or this inspiration of geology, is a rejection of that idea. And that's critical, because that's a rejection of Fraser. Fraser, really, when he did his volumes on the Golden Bough, still preserved the idea that there were primitive religious beliefs associated with animism and magic that lead through to different stages of religion and then ultimately to science. Levi-Strauss rejects that notion, but he does so, in a sense, as a geologist.
His structuralist ideas emerge more fully developed in his book La Pensée Sauvage. What's going on in this book?
Yes, La Pensée Sauvage, I mean, I think it's a great shame that where Tristes Tropiques preserved its original title, La Pensée Sauvage didn't. And instead it's translated as The Savage Mind. And a lot of people then presume that it means the mind of savages. Whereas it is a pun. It's a pun on a French wildflower, where sauvage is associated with wildness and associated with the forest. La Pensée Sauvage is not the savage mind or the primitive mind. It's about natural mind and natural thought. And the most famous essay, I think, is the first essay in that book, an essay entitled The Science of the Concrete. And there, Lévi-Strauss commences with a detailed demonstration that non-Western, non-modern peoples indulge in the classification of their worlds because they have that fundamental human curiosity for the world. Further to that, Lévi-Strauss then goes on to talk about how these systems of thought, whereby people engage with their worlds and, in a sense, make their worlds meaningful, provide them with a finite set of elements of what's immediately at hand, which they not only classify, but then classify the classifications and build together the various types of analogy between one set of classifications and another set of classifications. And we're this enabling them to do things like classify their kin according to various categories and their non-kin according to various categories, but to link those classifications to their classifications of the natural world. And he called this process of mixing and matching, if you like, he called it after the French term for a jack-of-all-trades handyman who'll come around to a house and repair something that's broken in the house, but use the materials that are immediately at hand and oftentimes break conceptual categories in order to do it. And this person in France is called a bricoleur. And from that, Lévi-Strauss coined this very famous term, bricolage. And bricolage is that process of classifying and then reclassifying, and that then is how humans put themselves into the world. And the task for the anthropologist then is the task of trying to unpack how these different systems of classification work.
On ABC Radio National, you're with the Philosopher's Zone, and I'm talking to Rowan Bastin from Deakin University about the work of the great anthropologist Claude Lévi-Strauss. Now, one of the reasons why Lévi-Strauss's work is of philosophical interest is that he was concerned with the way in which human beings classify the world about them. In this, he was assisted by the work of the 19th century Swiss linguist Ferdinand de Saussure. According to Saussure, the meaning of a sign in a language, a word say, is determined not by its content, but by its context. In other words, the meaning of a word is given by what it distinguishes itself from. So there's a real sense in which cat means not a dog. And just as Saussure argues that linguistic signs acquire meaning only through their relations with one another, Lévi-Strauss said the same about human culture. The basic unit, for example, is not the family, but the members of the family, and what matters about them is the relation between them.
The key to this approach is a relational theory of meaning. And that relational theory of meaning is fundamentally built upon elements which are in and of themselves meaningless. And connected to that, Saussure also argued for the arbitrariness of the sign and how the meaning of signs then derives always from its relationship to other signs. That's the key for Lévi-Strauss. Lévi-Strauss really said that all of these systems of classifications by which humans, you know, render the world intelligible to themselves have at their heart relational meanings between categories which in and of themselves don't have any meaning. It's something that the philosopher Paul Ricoeur would later call le sens de non-sens, or the meaning of non-meaning, somewhat critically. But I think Ricoeur like a number of the other French philosophers who were contemporaries of Lévi-Strauss, could recognise that he was onto something.
Now, if we're talking about these relationship between elements that have no meaning in themselves, the most obvious way of finding such a relationship is by identifying contrasts. So you have a kinship system of male and female, of kin and non-kin, or you have a system consisting of the edible and the inedible, the cooked and the raw, and so on. But it's more than a question of binary oppositions, isn't it?
Indeed. Lévi-Strauss would say that the simplest organisational scheme would be a binary one. And we can recognise that in computer programming. And indeed, for Lévi-Strauss, a computer would represent the most basic and fundamental of human intellectual capabilities, because it does work with a basic contrast set or gate system. This basic binary system, which is then obvious in something like a kinship system, where, as you say, you have your contrast male-female, but you also have a contrast of nature and culture, which defines kin and non-kin as organised by the incest taboo. And the incest taboo then identifies something like the wife givers and the wife receivers, so that there are people you don't marry and people you do, and that a whole universe of relationships can then be built up from these elementary structures which are based on basic contrast sets. But not everything is reducible in Lévi-Strauss's world to simply binary logics. A lot of people, I think, misunderstood Lévi-Strauss in this regard. I know a friend of mine describing his time in Oxford in the 1970s, where it was normal to describe someone who was enamoured with Lévi-Strauss's work as having a bad case of the binaries. But I think that really misrepresents Lévi-Strauss. I think what we're seeing there is certainly fundamental contrast sets in how humans make the world, but when they move into the world of figures of speech and analogous systems, it's not only about contrast sets, it's also about metaphor and various types of representation, and these structures then become considerably more complex.
When you talk about metaphor, it seems to me you move beyond a system structured around elements that are in themselves meaningless, because metaphor depends upon meaning. Similarly, if you're talking about male and female, you're talking surely about a natural given rather than simply something that is the result of my classification.
Yeah, and that's true. But when, for example, there's a marvellous little essay by Lévi-Strauss in one of the collections entitled Structural Anthropology, where he talks about the sex of the sun and the moon and how in different cultures the sun and the moon are given a gender. And the key point about that is, in good Saussurean terms, it's arbitrary. There's no sort of necessity for the sun to be male and the moon to be female. But what's important is that they are both set up as a contrast, sun-moon, and also potentially given that other aspect of meaning, which is to be male or female. And so you can talk about the intrinsic qualities of something, what makes a man, a woman, and Lévi-Strauss would have no problem with that. But it's when we move into the realms of representation that the sense and the reference that is associated with that metaphor or figure of speech begins to follow its own logic and not be constrained by some kind of innate characteristic.
If you talk about the sun and the moon, though, many people have identified the moon with the female, and I suppose we'd say a reason for doing that is that women have monthly menstrual cycles and men don't. Now, that's not a given in nature that makes the moon female, but on the other hand, it seems to me a lot more than merely arbitrary.
Well, why? Why is it more than arbitrary?
Because I have identified a similarity between women's bodies, or what happens to women's bodies, and what happens to the moon.
And you're quite right for having done so, and you're in the company of many, many different humans in many, many different parts of the world who have done the same thing. But the concept of the arbitrariness of the sign is whether you, or rather your conceptual system, chooses to draw that relationship. And once you choose to draw that relationship, then the data comes flooding in to fill it, as you mentioned, for example, reproductive cycles. But the choice to make it is ultimately with you. And in that little essay, what Lévi-Strauss shows is there are peoples in the world who don't do this.
Lévi-Strauss's last years were marked by a growing melancholy about the human future. Was that simply because of the end of the non-Western peoples, or the dissipation of the non-Western cultures to which he had devoted so much of his time, or was there more to it than that?
No, I think there was a lot more to it. One of the things that's evident in Lévi-Strauss's work, I mean, even there in Tristram and Isolde, he's lamenting a passing world and aware that, you know, the very thing that he's trying to capture and celebrate, which is that sense of innate human genius that stands irrespective of whether one is a so-called primitive or one is a modern, that this world was being overwhelmed and that nothing was replacing it, that sort of glorious human spirit that he tried to celebrate as a universal human spirit, the capacity that humans have, their rage to classify and make the world and make things in the world and fundamentally have that aesthetic sense of the world, which impels them so powerfully, that there was nothing that was coming into it. So you see, for example, in his later writings, you know, he really developed his long-standing interest in classical music. Indeed, much of his work, he would later say that if we really want to understand a good analogy to mind, think of it in terms of music, don't think of it in terms of language, that we have to understand it as being like music, and it's all about creating rhythm and form, you know, the basics of aesthetics. And so with that, you have his deep appreciation of music, tremendous appreciation, for example, of Wagner, but also a marvellous essay in the end of the Mythologique on Ravel's Bolero. It's a description which I just adore. And with that too, a tremendous interest in painting. His father was a painter, and he always had a deep, passionate interest in European art. I think as he grew older, he wasn't seeing the music or the painting anymore. He wasn't seeing with this massively growing human population that was steadily destroying the world, as we are. He was seeing a failure in the aesthetic sense, and I think that was a source of despondency to him.
Well, a sad note on which to end that tribute to the French anthropologist Claude Lévi-Strauss, who died in October at the age of 100. You've been listening to Associate Professor Rowan Bastin from the Anthropology Department at Deakin University. And if you want to be heard on the subject of Lévi-Strauss or anything else philosophical, go to our website and click on Add Your Comment. It's at abc.net.au/rn/philosopherszone. The Zone is produced by Kyla Slaven, with technical production by Charlie McCune. I'm Alan Saunders, and I'll be back next week with the first in our series of highlights from the philosophical year.
You've been listening to another ABC Radio National podcast. ABC Radio National, on air and online, with many of our programs available as podcasts or MP3 downloads. all the details at abc.net.au/rn/podcast.